Hi, today is July 16, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 166. I'm Todd Ogasso-Ward, my good friend John Westfall. And we have a special guest today, Frank McPherson, who returns to our little group, as he does every now and then. Feel free to chime in anytime, Frank.
Okay.
So the first thing I wanted to mention is because it's something that I had some direct experience with, is that Google says that their Google Fi cellular network, which in the U.S. uses Sprint and T-Mobile U.S., is going to be faster when traveling internationally because they've added a carrier named Three, T-H-R-E-E, to their international Fi network. And apparently it's supposed to be faster speed than the T-Mobile, you know, whatever you are, or T-Mobile in Europe at least. So we'll see how that works. It says Project Fi subscribers, 135 addition of Three to the project, we're now able to deliver speeds 10 to 20 times faster before. No extra fees, $10 per gigabyte as you do at home. By the way, that's $10 separate from the $10 you pay at home. So, you know, you're at home, you're using Google Fi, you use, you know, however many megabytes or gigabytes. And then when you travel, it's a separate bucket. So you pay an additional whatever, you know. So if you used only, if you use 1 gigabyte here in the U.S., well, let's say you use 0.5 gigabyte here in the U.S., which is $5, and you use, you know, another $5 worth of data while you're traveling, that's actually a separate fee. But anyway, it's cheap no matter what.
So I wonder, you said that when you were over across the seas,
yeah,
you had actually gotten faster speeds than you had expected. I wonder if they had already started bringing Three on board.
Well,
when you
know,
were there,
I have on my Nexus, I have a little app called, I should get the name right to give the guy credit. I have a little app called Signal Spy, which is a free Android app, which tells you which network you're connected to. And while I was in the UK, I was always connected to T-Mobile if I had any connection at all. So, no, Three was not there yet. I will say this, though. So, let's see. I was in all over Scotland, you know, starting in Edinburgh, down the south part of the country, up to Skye in the north. And I could see when I was on LTE or 3G or GPRS. By the way, when it says GPRS, you got nothing. There's no data, essentially. It just didn't
work. Oh, yeah.
But
it never worked well when that was all we had.
That's right. So. But in any case, when I saw LTE, I got pretty good speeds. Now, I didn't actually do tests because I didn't want to, you know, use a lot of data because I didn't really know what it was doing the first time around. But, I mean, it felt LTE speed. You know, you open a browser, you do something, check your mail, you know, whatever. It didn't have that sluggishness as, for example, whenever I connected a Sprint network here in the U.S., it just feels sluggish all of a sudden. Anybody who's used Sprint and can compare it to other networks know what I mean. Despite what they say, it just feels slow, at least where I live. Now, when I was in London, on my second trip to the UK, I saw LTE speeds every day except for the day and a half where T-Mobile UK essentially was down. It just didn't work at all. So I thought I was seeing pretty fast speeds there. Now, by fast, I mean, you know, a couple megabits per second, because what Google Fi advertised is that you'd get about 256 kbps, kilobits per second, when you are overseas. So I was expecting pretty slow service, but it didn't feel like it to me. But in any case, I missed out because now I could have had even better service if I were traveling abroad with it. And I don't have any plans to travel abroad. Actually, anymore at all. I don't like traveling.
Ever again.
I do not like traveling. I mean, I do it because I have to. I don't do it because I enjoy it, generally speaking. And I don't enjoy going to places. I just don't like the whole process of waiting in the airport and getting delayed by the airlines and losing my baggage and all that stuff. I just don't enjoy any of that. Anyway, so there you are. Google Fi, if you're traveling internationally, it really works well. I think I was in the UK for about 10 days in April, and I think I paid $3.50 for data, and with some voice calls I made, I paid maybe $4.50, something like that. And this last trip, I was there a week, and I paid, you know, again, about $4 for voice plus data. International, you know, if anybody's ever turned on the international plan from, say, AT&T, which I did the first trip as a backup, it was $30 for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was $30 just to have a plan as a backup. I think it was 80 megabytes of data. 80 megabytes, not gigabytes. So it was essentially useless. You know, you check a few emails, you browse a web page, you check a map, and you're done. You have no more data. And then you start paying some horrendous fees. So Google Fi was a lifesaver on my two trips to the UK this year.
You know, the interesting thing about that is I wonder how many networks Google Fi can be connected to. The one it's also on a third network in the U.S. now, and that's U.S.
Right.
Cellular.
Yeah.
So that's three U.S. networks and this network in Europe.
Two in Europe.
Two in Europe. So that's five in total, right? So, right. I mean, I assume there are some compatibilities in terms of frequency and the type of radios that the phone has to have. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to get to that kind of holy grail of a SIM card basically being able to work on just about any carrier that you would need to be connected to. I would imagine some of the big players like AT&T and Verizon are never going to get on board with something like Google Fi, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of these little regional carriers like U.S. Cellular in the United States that, you know, this might be an interesting way to kind of get the U.S. coverage to fill in the gaps for Sprint and T-Mobile.
Right. And just to reiterate what I said earlier, so because I normally you don't know which network you're on, by the way, when you're on Google Fi, but there are some third-party tools like the one I mentioned, Signal Spy, which is what I use. There's also another one called Fi Info that tells you which cellular network you're on, or cellular data network, or and voice for that matter. And so I can tell when I'm on Sprint or T-Mobile, and it does switch off. I'm not sure why it switches off and when, because generally speaking, where I am, T-Mobile and Sprint, you know, have about equivalent coverage, which is pretty good, by the way, generally speaking. You know, where I am, it's a pretty urban, suburban area, so there's like no dead spots anymore.
And so, Todd, you have Google Fi. I don't. Yep. The one thing I was curious about is it switches to the Wi-Fi network to
yes.
fill in gap as well, right?
It does.
But I assume that only works in networks you actually know about. Would it just grow an open network if you're walking down the street and try to use it, or is there a little more restriction on it?
You know, I won't say for sure, but I will say this. I know that when I was in the Isle of Skye in Scotland, I had no T-Mobile service at all. I could not make a voice call from the street. But the hotel I was in did have free Wi-Fi service, and I got a fairly important phone call via Wi-Fi, you know, Wi-Fi calling or whatever they call it, while in the hotel room. So at least, you know, because I was logged into the hotel's Wi-Fi, I was able to get a voice call from the U.S., even though T-Mobile had no service where I was. Yeah. So
how was the quality of the conversation?
It was very good. It was very good. The hotel, the little hotel I was in Isle of Skye, we had pretty good. I mean, they themselves didn't say, it's okay, you know, when I asked them about it. But really, it was about 10 down, 1 up or something like that, 5 down, 1 up. Nothing to write home about, but it was certainly enough for, you know, voice quality, which only needs, you know, voice. You can get by with 8 kbps for a fairly decent quality. And I know it's you know, at home, I've got, you know, there's a little indicator that's in Wi-Fi when I get a call on my phone and that sort of thing. So it does work. And like I said, it was a real boon when I was in an area that actually had no cell service for my phone. But I have to say, you know, it's not a perfect service, but it's cheap. You know, it's $20 a month for unlimited voice and texting, and it's $10 per gigabyte, and I only subscribe to 1 gigabyte. And if you don't use the full gigabyte, then you can have more, of course. It refunds you to rest. So, you know, if I use...
Unfortunately, you're still limited to a small set of phones, right? Pretty much just the Google Nexus phones.
Just the Google Nexus phones. But, you know, the interesting thing is if you have a tablet and you want just the data part of it, it supports things like an iPad mini. So if you have an LTE iPad mini, you can actually stick a SIM in there and tether it to your plan, which requires a Nexus phone. So that's pretty cool. And that didn't happen until, of course, after I bought my iPad mini last year. So otherwise, I might have sprung for the LTE just to have that feature. It's pretty handy. It would be pretty handy to have, I imagine. Any case, so that's Google Fi. Yeah, I guess if I travel internationally again, which I don't plan to ever again, the flight from Honolulu to the Europe is brutal, to say the least. It's actually two flights. And the last time, it took me 30 hours to get home because American Airlines, which apparently has had a series of problems in the last couple of weeks, had some kind of mechanical failure in the plane that was supposed to take me home, and I was delayed 3 hours in LAX, in addition to the 3 hour, you know, that 3 hours I was supposed to see her. So I was in LAX for 6 hours. Should have probably taken a tour of LA in that time. But in any case.
In 6 hours in LA, you could have at least gotten about 5 miles away from LAX with traffic.
Yeah, I could have gotten a burger or something, you know.
Yeah. Gotten back.
Okay. The next item I wanted to mention, actually it's an old white paper that I ran across when I was reading Hacker News. You know, the Y Combinator list of news items. And it's from 2012, and I found this kind of interesting because although I don't have USB, let me rephrase it. I do have USB 3.0, you know, devices, although I'm not sure I have. Yeah, I do. But, you know, I'm not sure how often it actually is used except to back up to an external drive. But in any case, Intel has a white paper about that's titled USB 3.0 Radio Frequency Interference Impact on 2.4 GHz Wireless Devices, which, in addition to Wi-Fi, you know, I think Bluetooth uses it, and there's a bunch of things that are on the 2.4 gigahertz frequency range. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, I'm not an RF engineer, and I don't pretend I will understand everything in there, but just knowing, you know, if you're getting some weird stuff, you might want to take a look. And it's only certain USB 3.0 cables, apparently. So, you know, take a look at that if you think you're having some problems.
I at my home, just to the proliferation of Wi-Fi networks as a whole, at my home, I've migrated some of my key machines to the 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi just to try to not get stomped on by my neighbors.
Yeah.
I was shocked one day. I was just having some weird problems with my network connectivity, so I installed a Wi-Fi analyzer app on my phone just to, you know, see what was out there, and it shows you the access points by the particular bands, and there was, oh gosh, it seemed like at least a half a dozen, if not more, access points on the same band on a 2.4 gigahertz. So I try to move things around, and eventually I just said, well, I've got the latest AC access point, and let me just move things up to 5 gigahertz. And that helped quite a bit, actually, in some of my throughput for things like the newest Chromecast and things like that. So that's something to look at, too, now, because just about every cable modem and that you get from Comcast, all the access points and that have Wi-Fi built in, and so, and they're all probably, especially like the Comcast ones, are probably all configured for the same channel.
Right.
And are given users that have no knowledge of how to change it.
When I lived in a bigger apartment complex, just the channel analysis was always interesting to look at. And also the number of smartphones that would be on personal hotspot that would still show up. You know, we relatively think of those as small range, but they'll still show up in echoes from time to time. But I would find that there would be 30 access points, and I could still find an open channel that no one else was using.
Yeah, because everybody was in channel 6.
Or 2.
Or 2,
and and you could just, you know, channel 12 or something like that was never used.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting problem, you know, as we get denser and denser use of Wi-Fi, and, you know, as Comcast and Time Warner and the big players put up Wi-Fi hotspots on telephone poles and in stores and things, it becomes even more interesting thing to try to deal with.
Well, here's the ironic part of where I'm living right now. In my apartment complex, there are 12 units, and I am the youngest resident by a good 30 years. And there are 6 other access points within my computer's range right now. And so it's interesting that people that you don't think would have Wi-Fi now have Wi-Fi. Well, and it, you'll find these signals all over the place.
Yeah, well, you know, like you said, a lot of them come with a DSL modem or the cable modem or whatever. I know my mom's DSL modem came built in with Wi-Fi.
Yeah, in fact, it's not even just the cable modem. See, what Comcast has done is they've got this Xfinity Wi-Fi that is part of their supposedly, quote-unquote, free Wi-Fi access to their Comcast customers.
Right.
What they do is they send open up a network on either any of your, you know, if you've got a cable modem with Wi-Fi built in. But they also have, like, a high-def set-top boxes that have the router and the Wi-Fi stuff built into it. So I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if there are people just using high-def TVs that go and get their set-top because, you know, that's what you got to have to get connected to, like, Comcast high-def.
Right.
And it is the Wi-Fi radio turned on for Xfinity Wi-Fi, and they don't even know about it.
Yeah. And, in fact, doesn't Comcast turn on a guest Wi-Fi on all of their Wi-Fi enabled routers unless you specifically opt out?
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah,
Xfinity Wi-Fi.
Okay.
That's what it's called. If you look for it, you'll probably find one. If you got a Wi-Fi analyzer anywhere in an apartment complex or a condo complex where I live, you'll probably find at least one or two of those easily.
Interesting.
I would agree with you, except for some weird reason, I've never lived anywhere with Comcast coverage.
Me either, by the way.
So, ironically, I have seen Xfinity, though, pop up when I've traveled, and you're right. It is amazing the number of people who have Wi-Fi access points that they don't know they have because of those setups.
Here, Time Warner, which was bought by Charter, I think some other cable modems Wi-Fi, but I don't think they have like a guest thing turned on. Although they do have about 2,000 Wi-Fi hotspots, independent hotspots, you know, spread all on telephone poles and things like that. But what I have noticed is Hawaiian Telecom, which is the ILEC here, their DSL routers tend to have Wi-Fi hotspots built in general, you know, just as a common thing. And I see, and you see an HT. And, you know, some 3 or 4 digit thing after it. And you see a lot of those Wi-Fi hotspots all over the place. They're all locked, though. They don't have, like, a guest mode turned on.
Well, unless you know the peculiarities of your local cable company. So both places that I've lived in the last 5 years have had just small independent cable companies, regional companies. Mm-hmm. There's no Time Warner, no Xfinity, no Charter. But the one that I lived, one that I was using when I lived in Louisiana, and they'll remain nameless to protect the
guilty.
The guilty. When they would set up your home Wi-Fi or your business Wi-Fi, they did something very nice. They actually did set a custom WPA key, but it was usually your phone number.
Oh, ow.
And so you could go to pretty much any business that had that, and if you found their private access point, you punched in their public phone number.
Yeah.
Because that was their business phone number. That was the number they gave to this company when they signed up. You'd connect to their private Wi-Fi.
Wow.
It was just the weirdest thing. I don't know. And I think it might have just been those installers in that area thought, oh, this is a great way to give customers a WPA key that they'll remember, forgetting that with corporate customers, this is literally the number on the door.
Yeah.
And then to make things even more complicated, I'm just looking at a Wi-Fi analyzer at my place right now. You have devices that are doing this direct Wi-Fi advertising. I see 2 Roku devices
right
where I'm sitting, a couple of HP printers. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that is clogging up our frequency, that band there that, you know, has been free and open for some of us that have been using this for ages and are used to being like the only person out there. Now it's like you're in a, you know, a traffic freeway out in California.
Yeah, I agree. I know when I had the only Wi-Fi hotspot in my neighborhood, now it's, I always have to, like you guys mentioned earlier, I have to sort of look at what everybody else is using and move my channel away from them.
I had a Wi-Fi hotspot that didn't even have web administration. I remember my first access point was a Belkin that you needed a proprietary piece of software just to configure.
And you know, some of the cheaper Wi-Fi hotspots don't seem to have anything. You know, you just basically plug it in. There's a WPA2 key on the pasted to the back of it, mm-hmm. and away you go. Yep. You don't even configure it.
Yeah, that's how our local cable company here, the modems that they give out, if you use one of their modems, it's got Wi-Fi built in, and it's got the WPA key right on it, so you never go into the configuration.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so unless you have more, we'll move it along. So move back to travel. I saw this the other day, that TripAdvisor. Now, I don't use TripAdvisor, I have to say, but I'm kind of thinking about logging in because I think I do have an account. I just never use it. TripAdvisor is now allowing people to write flight reviews of individual flights. Now, I'm not sure how fair that is because, hey, you've got a different pilot. You might even have a different plane on, you know, any given flight. But I thought it was kind of interesting because I have something to say about Flybe in the UK, which is a budget airline. So I took my daughter and I took Flybe from Edinburgh to Manchester earlier this year. Because it's a budget airline, so it was in a pretty reasonably priced to get down from Edinburgh to Manchester. But in any case, their overhead bin was so tiny, I could not fit my standard size backpack. I'm not talking about a giant hiking backpack. You know, just a regular backpack that you might take to work kind of backpack. And it wasn't even particularly full, and I could not get it in overhead. So I had to put it under my legs because it wouldn't fit under the seat either. So I just kind of violated all kinds of rules. I saw a guy with one of those larger rollaways that, you know, obviously wouldn't fit either. And he literally has his legs on top of it because it wouldn't fit anywhere. And they didn't ask us to check it in. And anyway, it was. And to make matters worse, we did have some check-in baggage. And it was 50 pounds per checked-in baggage for Flybe. So whatever you make, unless you're taking everything with you in a very tiny bag, the savings you get on the actual flight is eaten up by baggage fees and the inability to take really anything larger than a woman's purse probably on board. So I'd add that to my TripAdvisor flight review.
It just seems like my old method, if you have the time, where I would just mail stuff to myself. You know, drop a bigger box off at the post office 2 days before I was going to arrive somewhere and have it waiting at the hotel when I got there. That's one way you could avoid these baggage fees, and it's probably cheaper than paying the baggage fees.
Yeah, for domestic, it probably is. I know in Japan, because, you know, you're pretty limited in what you can take on board the bullet train, for example. Mm-hmm. They have a number of baggage transport services where, you know, from one hotel to another, it's not even from your home to hotel. From one hotel, you just have it picked up at your hotel. They take it to your next hotel that you're going to check into. You take the bullet train over to wherever you're going. You get there, your bag's there, you're ready to go. It's beautiful. Now, it turns out for international, not so beautiful because we considered doing that. My daughter had, you know, my daughter was in the UK for 5.5 months, I think. And so, you know, she didn't have it, you know, just a carry-on with her. She had two big suitcases and stuff of stuff to bring back. So I went over to help her move her stuff back. And I took no check-in baggage, by the way. You know, so basically what happens is we looked at the idea of using one of these baggage transport services, but I think it was like $700. For one suitcase, so we figured, well, what the heck, Dad's coming over, so we'll figure it out. But yep, and domestically, it's a real good service if you've got it and it's reasonably priced. But anyway, I should also mention £50, you know, pre-Brexit was about $70 U.S. dollars, so it was expensive to check in baggage on Flybe, not my favorite airline. Okay, next week we already talked about Pokemon Go last week, but at that point, I think neither of us had tried it. Frank, have you tried Pokemon Go at all? I have not.
So for the sake of actually speaking from a point of knowledge versus a point of conjecture, I actually installed Pokemon Go today, mostly because I was bored. And I've got a couple of reactions I thought I would share. Everything that you've heard about it being buggy is true.
Okay.
It has problems loading, it has problems staying open, etc. And if you think this is a game where all you do is just collect Pokemon, that's true. That is really all you do with it. I found it very interesting that I have now made it to level 4, almost level 5, by just sitting and waiting for Pokemon to come to me. So that's been a pretty useful... I think I'm running more of a Pokemon collective or sanctuary here, where I'm not trying to catch them. They're just trying to come associate with me. And I did sit at a restaurant where one of my friends, who's more into Pokemon dropped a lure, and so I caught a bunch of random things I really didn't want. But hey, why not, you know? And I will say it's an interesting diversion. It's kind of fun if you like seeing what's going to pop up. Now, I have been sitting here. I've had it running the entire time we've been podcasting. Okay. I haven't caught crap. So, you know, apparently they're not wandering by outside this time of night. But, you know, it's kind of interesting. It is very interesting that they're using the same spots that Niantic found with Ingress. So the historical markers around my area where most of the Poke stops are, because they were Ingress, Ingress called that. So yeah, it's kind of a fun idea. I think it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. I think I don't really think I'll be doing much. Although my one friend who has had some time this week, this was her excuse to get out and walking around. She's explored places that she has lived nearby but never actually looked at. And so I guess that's pretty cool.
But, yeah, but I have two discordant views of Pokemon Go. On one hand, you know, it's got people walking around, which seems like a good idea. It's got people talking to each other, even strangers, which can be good or bad, you know, depending, given the way the world is today. But, you know, it's good that people are talking to each other. It seems to be a very social activity, you know, where, like I said, either strangers are, like, talking to each other in the street because of a common activity, or friends are getting together in groups. Kind of like bar hopping, except I guess you're Pokemon hopping.
And it is nice that the game, if you are chasing a Pokemon in an area, it's not exactly the same for everyone. So if someone takes that Pokemon, it's not like you won't get that Pokemon either.
Yeah.
So that I could see that making it much more of a, oh, gee, how's this going to work out if, you know, there's 20 people here and one guy gets the one Pokemon and everyone else gets screwed. I could see that being a testy subject, but it seems like they appear with a bit of a jitter. Some people in the same location will see them, others won't, and some, you know, there'll be multiple copies of the same one that are, you know, available to everyone. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and my beef with Pokemon Go, on the other hand, so, you know, on one hand, I think it's a good thing. It's getting people together, it's getting people outside and active, all that's always good. On the other hand, it's annoying me personally. Because I was in a supermarket the other day, and a mom with her kids and husband were in there. The mom was playing Pokemon Go. It was pretty obvious what she was doing. The kids were going, Mom, and she was, like, blocking an aisle, and I was trying to get through, and other people trying. It was just really annoying. Okay, so that's the minor end of it. It's merely annoying. I think the military is getting a little testy because people are going on military grounds to catch their Pokemon, and they're not supposed to be there. I know the Honolulu Police Department has issued some warnings to folks about safety and appropriate behavior and all that kind of thing. So, you know, as with many fun things, people have managed to make it annoying and in some cases ugly.
What'd you say, Todd? I wasn't listening. I just caught something.
I don't know. So, Frank, I take it you haven't played it either.
I muted myself. I've been amused by the stories about people playing. There is, well, and some of them have been kind of positive. There was one couple who decided to start playing it out to dinner and, you know, say, well, let's play for a while. And they start wandering down the neighborhood and they found themselves in front of a house that turned to actually be on fire.
Oh.
So they, and the people that lived there were not at home, so they were able to call the fire department and the fire was put out and they were saved. Wow. The dog, the family pet that was in the house and everything. So wow, that was kind of a positive feel good story.
Yep.
The couple would not have been down that particular street with if they weren't playing Pokemon Go.
They got to catch the dog and evolve it. And
yeah. And then there was another story of a guy apparently this game is kind of immersive or something, and you don't really pay attention to where you're going. Because yes, one guy who apparently had an open warrant out for his arrest was playing and wandered into a police station in Michigan and managed to get himself arrested. So I kind of, you know, I do, you know, just seeing people in how they use their phones to just read things like text messages and Facebook. I can only imagine, you know, how that's probably amped up by a factor of 10 in terms of their attention span and focus on the phone screen and walking into things or where to places they shouldn't be going.
Right. I think what makes this worse is that Pokemon Go is supposed to be an augmented reality game, so you're supposed to be looking at the world with Pokemon in it. But because having a camera on all the time kills your battery, people are turning off the augmented reality portion of it, and they're basically just catching Pokemon blind, I guess. I don't know how that works, John. But so they're not seeing the world through their phone, which is what it was designed to do.
Yeah, and when you have the augmented reality piece on, it can be harder to actually play the game. And so I haven't turned on the augmented reality piece. Of course, as we've established, I am stationary. So I am doing the exact opposite of what most people are doing with this game. And so, yeah, if I were walking around, I might turn on the actual augmented reality. Well, but
you know, that might be a really interesting variant of the game, right? So see how high, what kind of score you can get by not actually moving out of your home or... Well, or, you know, or a certain neighborhood, you know, kind of do a limited game kind of thing. Like in Civilization Revolution, for example, which is my favorite game on the iPad, you can play scenarios where the cities cannot grow more than, you know, X. And normally can get to, you know, X plus 20 or something. So you have to work with small towns or small cities versus big cities and see how many points you can get given that limitation. So it might be interesting to have a limited version. And which gets me to my other thing is if Niantic / Google and Nintendo are listening, which I doubt, but in the small chance that somebody there is listening, we really need geofences for this thing because, you know, I'd hate to see somebody plow into an area that turns out to be, for example, you know, filled with toxins and they get sick or worse, die. You know, so an environmentally hazardous area.
You know, you did mention Google, though. I bet you there's some people who are at Google who worked on Google Glass that are probably thinking and seeing all this and saying, geez, I wish we would have thought about doing something like that with Google Glass.
Yeah.
Because that would have probably been the way. Now it would have probably chewed through battery like crazy.
Yeah.
But that is really the augmented reality, the forte of it, right? To be able to just see it right in front of your eyes and, you know, see around you and have this thing projected on top of it. That is augmented reality.
Right. For the 30 minutes your battery lasts, it'd be great. Although, you know, one of our friends, was it Don, John? I don't know if you remember seeing it on Facebook. But one of our friends mentioned looking out his door and saw a kid there, you know, obviously playing Pokemon Go. And he had a battery backpack with a solar panel on his back. So this kid was prepared for the game. I mean, he was a serious Pokemon Go player.
Well, all you need is a little beanie hat with the panel on the top of it as opposed to the propeller.
Yeah.
Just to run down to your Google Glass and you could go all day.
And the other thing that's interesting about this, so there is a accessory that is releasing soon that's the Pokemon Go Plus. That's basically a little button that you don't need to have the app open. You can use that. It's a physical button to do that. But I read somewhere this week just a headline saying, you know, this would be a killer app for, say, the Apple Watch or even a Google, you know, or an Android Wear Watch. Because as you're walking around, hey, you get a little notification. There's Pokemon right there. You can stop, use your watch, and try to catch it. Now, I don't suggest that you go and pick up the matching Pokemon robe that you can buy at GameStop that also would, you know, complete your outfit. But,
oh,
you know,
I have some friends who are probably going to do that.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. $12.97. but I think there are some good things, and we'll just have to kind of keep an eye on this. The only worry I have is with the fact that people are catching Pokemon while driving.
That is scary.
Yeah, and around a college campus... My college campus has a good number of Pokestops, and Pokemon like to hang around there. So I have noticed random people slowly driving around, which, you know, the campus speed limit is 15 miles per hour anyway. But still, I could see that getting distracting, especially when classes start again at the end of August. Of course, by then, this whole fad could be completely gone.
Okay, we'll so two items before we leave this topic and get to our last topic is... One, I noticed two local businesses have Pokemon Go events this weekend where they're inviting Pokemon Go players to come over to their establishment to do, you know, I don't know if they're setting up like lures or something for the little Pokemon. I don't exactly know the game dynamics or game mechanics. But
yeah, businesses can pay real money to set up a lure.
And the second thing is a question for you guys is something you just mentioned, John. So is this a fad or something that's going to, you know, be forever in some significant form versus a niche form? I think it's a fad. I think in 6 months we'll be talking, we won't be talking about it. It's like Angry Birds. It was, it was popular for a year or a year and a half and then now nothing.
Well, I think what's interesting about it, though, is it is introducing the concept of augmented reality. I mean, this is probably going to be the most widely used augmented reality app. Probably debate on how many people are using it in that mode, apparently. Yeah. But, as opposed to, you mentioned the Google app, the Ingress app, I think was similar to it. Yeah. But I don't think near as many people used it. So this is going to really broaden augmented reality. So that might lead to better things.
Yeah,
not just this game, but, something maybe a little more useful.
Yeah. As far as I can figure out, this is Ingress with, branding slapped onto it. Because as John mentioned, I think if you know where the Ingress portals are, you know where the Pokemon are. At least that's what I was told by somebody who knows a lot more about this stuff than me. And you're right. It is a way. It is a way to get AR into the hands of a lot of people, although people are turning off the AR part. But maybe it'll encourage people like Apple to get away from their silly, thinner-than-a-piece-of-paper phone concept and give us bigger batteries with more life. Because people are going to need more, you can buy a Mophie battery pack or, do what the kid did with a solar panel on his back. But honestly, my phone is thin enough. Stop making it thinner. Give me some bigger batteries. So I can go 3 days, if I'm not playing Pokemon Go, and one day if I am.
And I'll just say, this is definitely a fad. I just am curious how long it's going to last. There's a part of me that says it might have the average lifespan of 6 months to a year, and then there's a part of me that wonders if next week no one will care about it anymore.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but certainly the people I know playing it are still very enthusiastic after a week of playing the game, so that's a good sign. It wasn't a 1 or 2 days, okay, now I'm tired of it kind of thing. People seem very engaged in it, and I think the social aspect is making it very, very engaging for them in addition to the gameplay. Okay, so next up, our last item on our list of things to talk about is John's discussion question.
Yeah, I'm a professor, so I have to ask these occasionally. I figured this would be good just because we do tend to cover a lot of news, and we don't tend to talk too much about the mobile stuff that we're doing.
Yeah.
And so my question, and I'll let you guys think about while I talk about my answer, is what mobile tech hack have you created that you're most proud of or that you basically show other people and they go, wow, that's kind of cool, or they might not even know how cool it really is, but, you show it off anyway. For me, this was about a year ago. I started playing around with persistent, what I'm calling a persistent reverse SSH tunnel. Anyone who's a geek that has ever used SSH knows that you can map ports from a remote machine to your local machine. This is how, for example, you get access to database servers when you're connecting and not having to open those ports directly to the world, et cetera. You can tunnel them over the protocol. But you can also do that in reverse. And so one of the things I've done is I have a couple of machines that are on a firewalled network that I don't control the firewall. And I have them basically creating a persistent connection to a very cheap server I have, basically a virtual private server that I pay, I think, $10 a year for, and I can tunnel SSH through that. So I have an open SSH port, I can use VNC, I can connect with native applications, I don't have to run anything special, and it really just amazes me how easily it was to kind of get up and running and how stable it has been. So that's, I guess, one of my favorite hacks, is that I can, from my phone, SSH or VNC into a machine that I don't have an open SSH port to directly.
Okay. I'm still thinking. Frank, you got anything?
Yeah, well, I'm not that geeky. I guess, the professor has a lot more time to come up with these things. No, I guess the closest thing I have, or I guess he mentioned something about being proud about it, I guess, is, one of the tools I use a lot is If This, Then That.
That's one of John's favorites, too.
Yep. And I don't think a lot of people know about it, and it helps you automate a lot of things so that maybe you can do things that you don't, you know, a lot of things that you'd rather not have to think about them. For me, you know, I go to church on Sunday, go to the church building during the week for various things. And, you know, one of the potentially most embarrassing things that could happen for a person if they're in church is in the middle of the pastor's sermon to have your cell phone go off. Because you got a phone call or you get a message from Facebook or something, and you get that embarrassment. I use If This Then That to program my phone so that when I go into the vicinity of that church, it silences my phone. So I don't have to think about it, right? You know, just mm-hmm. the whole, you know, you go to the movie theater and you get the little message up there that says, okay, please turn off your phone now. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things like that where you'd rather your phone didn't ring, that somebody isn't there to tell you and remind you. And If This Then That is a tool because it has an ability to, you know, that geofence or that, you know, a location awareness to say, okay, if I'm at this location on the map in this building, then silence my phone. So in general, If This Then That is one of those tools that I have that I use that when I show my friends things like situations like that, that they say, oh, I never knew I could do that. And it's a very easy thing to use, actually. It's not a programming language by any means. It's very graphical and, you know, click a few buttons and the way you go.
Okay, so.
That definitely fits the bill for what I was thinking for this. You know, that is definitely something I think most people will look at and go, that's really neat. I wish I could do that. Yours is just much easier to set up than mine.
So mine
which makes it much better.
Mine then is even easier because you don't have to add anything. So if you have an Android phone, at least one, I'm running Marshmallow, I guess, M. I'm not running Nutty McNuckface yet. If you have a calendar event set in your, you know, in your Google Calendar, at least for my phone, it automatically silences my phone during that event. So if I have a meeting or something like that, or, you know, I also put in, you know, I'm going to the movies, and I'll put that into my calendar, A, to remind me that I need, you know, to get there 30 minutes beforehand, and I just put in the whole duration, and it silences my phone automatically. So I don't even have to think about it when I walk into the theater, so that's kind of nice. And I don't need a geofence, it just needs to know time. The second thing, is it morbid? Maybe. But you can use it for lots of things. So on Apple phone, the reminder, is it called a reminder app on the Apple phone? I have to look at it now. On an Apple phone. On the iPhone, there is a built-in app from Apple called Reminder, which, you know, kind of does exactly what you think, right? It reminds you about stuff. But one of the things it can do is it can remind you specifically, like what Frank was talking about with IFFT, If This Then That, IFTTT, like it, you can have it set up for a particular location. So in my case, you know, I can never find my dad's gravestone. And it's not one of those big, huge monuments. It's just flat, you know, on the ground. So it's not obvious. They all look the same. And it's on a giant cemetery. So I have it set up so as soon as I get to the cemetery, it tells me, okay, go look for this spot. Walk down this row and, you know, you'll find dad, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. On a less morbid note, I also have it set up so if I don't know when I'm going to Costco or the supermarket, I just set it up so next time I get to this place, you know, remind me to go buy this as soon as I get there. So, you know, if I'm going to Costco, you know, go buy 52 rolls of something or other, of paper towels, and there you go. So, anyway, built in, if you have an iPhone, it's called Reminder. It's from Apple. And it works pretty good, although, you know, once I had it set up to remind myself to buy pet food, and it turns out I passed a pet store twice a day, going home and, you know, going to work. So it would remind me constantly, you got to buy pet food, you got to buy pet food, until I finally went to the store and actually bought the pet food and, you know, turned off the reminder. But very handy, so that's not a hack.
And then the very next day, your pets put the reminder back in.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they have a... I think they learned to use the Amazon Echo, and they just sort of, you know, voice control it. I wonder if they're buying stuff. I should look at my purchase list on Amazon, see if they're buying stuff.
Oh, they are.
That is frightening.
And I, as one thing, when Frank was talking about being at a church and having your phone and silencing your phone, that is one of my paranoid worries, because at my church I tend to be the guy making the announcement to silence your cell phone. And so if mine goes off, that's a problem. I have a microphone here.
Okay, so I have seen several times, unfortunately, phones ring during a funeral and the person answering. So I spent like 30 seconds thinking, what is more embarrassing, having that person just be an idiot or me walking up and slapping that person across the head? So, but anyway.
Unless it's the dead calling, in which case they're a genius.
Oh,
yeah.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
It would be awesome.
Then no one will slap them up the side of the head.
On that supernatural note, which is a spillover from Conspiracy Views podcast, we will bring Mobley's podcast number 166 to end. I want to give thanks to our mutual good friend, Frank McPherson, for popping on by. And, of course, my co-host, John Westfall. Thanks for staying up late, folks. I know it's getting late where you guys are. It's still mid-afternoon, well, late afternoon for me. It's like almost 5 p.m. here, but I know we've got quite a bit of time difference. So thanks for staying up and participating in this call. And we'll talk to you next time. John will not be on the next podcast because he's too busy to bother with it. But
it's something with driving 16 hours and then being in another place for the weekend and then driving back.
Excuses.
It's hard to slot in. You know what? You say that and I'll find some way to call in over Skype.
Right. And of course, I should say I did not figure out how to do it from Scotland, so I am not blaming. But anyway, we'll have some other friends on as John is en route to wherever he's going. Okay, we will talk to you next time.